Remember, we talked about the division psychedophyta within the gymnosperm group. And the next division that we want to talk about is the division netophyta. The division netophyta are desert plants. They've evolved to live in very, very harsh environments. They have some unique vascular tissue that allows them to live in those desert environments. And another characteristic is that most of them photosynthesize with their stems, which is, again, kind of unique. The horsetails, of course, photosynthesize with their stems, and some of the netophyta do as well. Probably the best known member of the netophyta that we have around here belongs to a genus called Ephedra. You guys have probably all heard of ephedrin before. Ephedrin comes from ephedra, and we actually have ephedra around here. Common name for it is Brigham tea, have it up in our mouths of our canes and stuff, and kind of the drier sites around here. Another genus in this group is the genus Nedum. Nedum produces a wood that is very, very beautiful, and is found in kind of Middle Eastern countries, Eurasia, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, that part of the world, yeah.
Is photosynthesizing from the stem, is that kind of like cloning off the roots?
No. What's happening is their stems are actually green. They don't photosynthesize with leaves. Okay. Probably what you're thinking about is rhizomes, reproduction by rhizomes. And these organisms, there are some that do reproduce asexually via rhizomes, but most of them do not. The third genus in this group is the genus Wallichia, which is found in Africa. And we'll take a look at some of these organisms as we go along. So the first genus that I want to talk about is ephedra. This is a picture of an ephedra plant or a Brigham tea plant. Some people call it Mormon tea, is another common name for this particular shrub. These organisms, the leaves are reduced. They do photosynthesize with their stems. This is a more close-up view of the ephedra plant here. And this is a really close-up view of the branches of the ephedra. You can see that the branches are actually green. They do have kind of a jointed appearance to them, but they're not hollow like we saw in Sphenophyta. And in addition, they produce pollen and seeds. But notice around the nodes here are kind of little brown structures. Those are the reduced leaves. And so photosynthesis does not occur in the leaves, it just occurs in the stems. This particular ephedra that we're looking at is a female, or is a male ephedra plant. Typically the sexes are separate in the ephedra, however, they can switch sexes, which is kind of interesting. They can actually switch from a male to a female plant and back to a male plant, which is kind of weird. But, scientists still don't understand exactly how they do that, but they're able to. The common name Brigham tea or Mormon tea, this particular plant can be used as a tea. If you take the branches and you boil it up, it makes a little tea. I think it's fairly good. My wife doesn't like me to make it though because she says it makes our house stink. She thinks it's nasty. But it does have ephedrine in it, which can, of course, cure things like headaches. It was also used in past times for, helps you to be less constipated, okay? Speeds things up a little bit. The ephedra that we actually, you've probably all heard of in, like for example, pain relievers, antihistamines, and those types of things. That ephedrin actually comes from the Chinese ephedra plant. So there's some ephedra that's around the world. Pseudoephedrin is a synthetic ephedrin that's been produced by humans, and of course you can't buy it over the counter anymore. So, any questions about the Mormon tea or Brigham tea? This is a Welwitschia plant. This is the plant that's found in South Africa, the southern part of Africa, I should say, in desert environments. It's kind of a strange plant. What will happen is during the wet season, it will grow these really long leaves from kind of a central trunk-like structure. This is kind of a view of the type of environment that you would find this plant, so pretty harsh desert type of environment. But they have this little, basically kind of like a trunk of a tree. When the dry period hits in these areas, the leaves dry up, and essentially all you're left with is a bunch of stumps. It almost looks like a forest that's been cut down because the tops of the woody part of the plant are really flat, and so it looks like somebody's cut the tree with a chainsaw or something. But they do produce a cone-bearing structure here in the center of the plant. This is a close-up view, kind of the woody part of the plant. You can see it does look like a trunk that's been cut by a chainsaw. You can see up in the top left-hand corner of the picture, some of the leaves are starting to dry out, and here you can see the cone-bearing structures in the plant. Any questions about the Nidophyta? Okay, the next division within the gymnosperms is the division Gynecophyta. The division Gynecophyta, or we sometimes call the ginkgo trees. There's actually only one extant species of Gynecophyta that exists on the earth today, and that's a species named Ginkgo biloba. Some of you might have heard of that before. Okay, so the species Ginkgo biloba is the only extant species in the world today. Ginkgo biloba is actually native to China. However, it has been moved throughout the world as an ornamental plant. Extracts from the Ginkgo biloba plant are used for, I guess you could say, some health food types of situations. Have any of you heard of Ginkgo biloba before? A few of you? What's it supposed to be able to do?
Enhance blood flow in the brain.
Okay. Enhance blood flow to the brain and increase your memory. So, you know, it might be helpful to some of you in this class for the test, right? Ginkgo trees, they're actually quite common in the United States. The key characteristic of the ginkgo, there's a couple of them. First of all, the leaves are very unique. They have what we would call a fan-shaped leaf. There's two leaves here in this picture, and you can see that it's really fan-shaped, and they're pretty much the only plant that has this shape of a leaf, or has this leaf shape. So their leaves look pretty much just like a fan that you would fan your face with, okay? And that's a fairly distinguishing characteristic. The ginkgos do have separate sexes, so there are male ginkgo trees and female ginkgo trees. And in most places in the world, if the tree is being used as an ornamental, only the male trees are planted. Okay. The reason why female trees are not planted typically in an ornamental situation is because the female trees produce a really smelly seed-like structure. And what it smells like the seed has butyric acid in it. I don't know if any of you know what butyric acid is. Anybody know what it is? It's actually the substance that we actually have some in our digestive system, and when you throw up, okay, you can actually smell throw up. All of you have smelled puke before, right? And what the smell, the chemical that's making it all puke kind of smell the same is butyric acid. And so when the females produce the seed drops, and it basically makes the whole area smell like somebody's puked on the ground. Okay. So it's not a very pleasant smell, and you can imagine hundreds of these fruits being dropped in your yard. You know, it wouldn't be a good thing. You will find some of these on college campuses, the first time I ever smelled this was up at Utah State campus, and when I walked up on campus one morning, I thought, boy, somebody had a real wild party last night, right? And a few people got sick, but really what it was these seeds from the ginkgo tree. And so that's why most of the time people will plant male ginkgo trees instead of female ginkgo trees in an ornamental situation. Ginkgo trees, one reason why they're so common throughout the developed world, and especially here in the United States, is because the ginkgo tree is not very susceptible to pollution. A lot of times pollution will have a drastic effect on plants, and so you'll find a lot of ginkgo trees in urban situations because they grow well. Pollution tends not to bother them at all. Okay? So you see a lot of them in cities. Right. Any questions about the ginkgo trees? The last division within the gymnosperm group is the division Coniferophyta. The Coniferophyta is probably the best known of the gymnosperm divisions. It includes organisms such as the pine tree. And most of the time when people think of Coniferophyta, they think of pine trees. Okay. For example, if you look up at the conifer trees up in our mountain, there's actually not a lot of pines, but people tend to call them all pine trees. Right? And most of you have kind of an idea of what a conifer tree looks like. The key characteristic of conifer trees is that they have scale-like leaves. Most scale-like leaves are needle in shape, and if you look really close at a needle, at a pine needle or a conifer needle, what you'll find is that they have scales basically that make up that needle shape. There are some conifers that don't have that needle-shaped leaf, but they still are scale-like. One example of this would be juniper trees that grow at the base of our mountains here. They also belong to the Coniferophyta. The Coniferophyta are found throughout the world in situations where there's usually something lacking in the soil. That's not always true, but usually something lacking. It might be acids or bases or something, so that angiosperm plants don't really grow well in many of these environments. There are parts of the world where conifers do dominate the landscape. In the southern United States, if any of you have been through the deep south, it's almost all conifer trees. Yellowstone is another place where there's lots of conifer trees. We have lots of conifer trees up our mountains in different places. And so the Coniferophyta is a very well-known group of plants. Okay? Typically, with conifers, they have both male and female reproductive structures in the same tree. The males produce pollen grains, and the fertilization occurs by wind-borne pollen. If you've ever been up in the mountains, especially in the springtime, a lot of times the snow will turn completely yellow, and it's not yellow because somebody urinated in the snow. It's yellow from the pollen grains from the conifer trees. And so this pollen is kind of spread via windborne pollination, and so there's lots and lots of pollen that never really fertilizes an ovum. The ovums are found within structures that we call cones. And most of you have seen a conifer cone before. There's lots of differences between different types of cones and different types of conifers. But that's where you'll find the seeds of the conifer plant, is within those cone-like structures. Okay. Actually, a lot of trees that we have up on this mountain up above us here, again, are not pine trees, but they're fir trees and spruce trees. Okay, and there's actually a pretty big difference between the spruces, firs, and the pines. Just kind of one example is in the firs, they actually have kind of a papery cone. Have you all seen pine cones that have the really papery bracts? They're not really stiff. Those are usually firs, and also the needles of firs are usually flat and not as pointy. Some of you have had Christmas trees that are really sticky, and then sometimes you get a Christmas tree that's not really sticky. If you have one that's not really sticky, it's probably a fir. Okay. So there are some big differences between the different conifer trees that we have around here. Any questions about the coniferophyta? This is just some examples of some different types of conifer trees. You've all seen trees like this one before, I'm sure. If you haven't, just go outside and look up in our foothills. This is a juniper tree here. This one is actually a pinyon pine. So there are some pines mixed with our juniper trees up here. Again, the pines have the really kind of the more pointy needles. Some forest ecosystems are dominated by conifer trees. The trees that you're looking at here, this one right here is actually a fir, and this one here is actually a spruce, these here, and then there's a pine right back here. Conifers are also found sometimes in swampy environments. This is a cypress swamp. Cypress trees are conifer trees as well. Just an example of, and then you can see in the background there those really tall conifer trees. Those are what they call loblolly pine. They're very common in the southern United States. They have really long needles. Any questions about the coniferophyta or the gymnosperms? Okay, the last group of plants then that we're going to talk about are what we call the angiosperm plants. The angiosperms all belong to one division, and that's the division Anthophyta. Okay, so then the angiosperms, there's only one division, and that's the division Anthophyta. The division Anthophyta are sometimes what we call the flowering plants, and all of the Anthophyta do have flowers, and we're going to talk about flower structure and how sometimes plants that you may not think have flowers actually do have flowers. The division Anthophyta is by far and away the largest division in the plant kingdom. Over 95% of all plant species in the world belong to the division Anthophyta, and also in terms of numbers of individuals, they are the most numerous plants on the face of the earth. Okay. So the flowering plants are by far and away the most common type of plant that you'll encounter outside. Probably the only other type of plant that you'll encounter regularly around here is plants from the division Coniferophyta. You might encounter some Netophyta, some Ephedra, or you know some of the other plant divisions that we've talked about around aquatic communities. But most of the time, if you're just walking out in the outdoors, you're going to be coming in contact with lots of different species of Anthophyta. We have a great diversity of flowering plants around here. In most areas, around where we live here in Sanpete County, even though we're kind of a semi-desert, we still have a very diverse plant community. Most areas an acre in size will have 100 to 200 plant species within that acre. Okay, and most of those plant species are flowering plants. Right? So just some examples of some flowering plants. This is typically what you think of when you think of a flower. Something with bright, showy petals, right? Kind of beautiful in nature. All flowers don't necessarily have to be beautiful. This is just another example of a flowering plant here. You can see in the flowering plants, most flowering plants have both male and female reproductive structures within the same flower. For example, in this flower here, we'll talk about the structure names here in a minute. This is the male reproductive part of the flower here, these long anthers. And then this is the female part of the flower there in the center. Okay. This is a Joshua tree. Joshua trees, as well as all of the cacti, are flowering plants. Another flowering plant that people don't typically think of as a flowering plant are grasses. Okay, grasses are flowering plants as well. Sagebrush is a flowering plant. As I mentioned, most of the plant species we have around here are flowering plants. Now, when you look at a flowering plant, if they have a nice showy flower like this with kind of brightly colored petals or brightly colored flowers, typically what that should tell you is that those flowers are going to be pollinated by animals. Okay? Flowering plants that have an animal pollinator typically have petals that are colored and they're kind of showy. Flowering plants that are pollinated by wind typically do not have colored petals. And so something like a grass plant, you wouldn't normally think that it's a flower, right? Okay, and why? Because it doesn't have those bright, showy petals on it. And that means that grass plants are probably going to be wind pollinated. Many of the flowering plants, like this one here, are what we consider to be weedy species. So not all flowering plants are what we would call good for humans or beneficial for humans. This is a thistle plant. Okay. There are all different types of flowers. If you look at the thistle flower versus this one here, which is a shooting star flower, you can see that there's differences in the petal shape and structure of the flower. And basically the differences in the structures of the flower, you can almost tell what type of pollinator pollinates a flower by the different shape of the flower. Okay. Insects are typically the most common pollinators around here. So bees, wasps, ants, butterflies, and moths, those are the most common pollinators around here. However, in the world, worldwide, there are other types of animals that do pollinate flowers, such as birds. And another important pollinator, at least in the tropics, are bats. Bats probably pollinate more species of flower than any other animal. Okay, and that's because in the tropics there are more species of flowers, and bats are the main pollinators.
How do birds do that?
They actually just come in and get the nectar, and it's a passive process. Pretty much with all animal pollinators, it's a passive process. So the animal comes in to get nectar within the flower, or to actually use the pollen for some reason, like bees and wasps. The pollen just gets on their feathers or their hair, in the case of a bat, or on the scopa of a bee, kind of the stuff on the belly of the bee. Does that make sense? What's that? Hummingbirds are pollinators, yeah. But there are other bird pollinators besides just hummingbirds as well. Like bee eaters, they call them bee eaters even though they don't eat bees. They're actually pollinators as well. So let's look at the structure and function of a flower, okay? Again, pretty much all flowers are put together in somewhat the same manner. There are some flowers that are modified to a great extent, and so they don't look like your typical flower. There are also many flowers in which the flower is wind pollinated, and they won't have these large showy petals. Let's just talk about the different parts of the flower, however. The first part that I want to talk about is this part right here, these little green leaves at the base of the flower. These are what we call the sepal. The sepals, even though it's not labeled on this picture, are some of the most important parts of the flower. One of the reasons why is because when a plant is producing a flower, it actually takes a lot of energy to make a flower. And most of the plant is photosynthesizing and producing energy for root growth, for branch growth, for leaf growth, those types of things. And only some of the energy is shunted or pushed towards the production of a flower. What happens is the sepals, even though they're kind of a smaller leaf, pretty much all of their photosynthates are pushed into the flower and into flower production. And so sepals are a very important part of the flower. If you've ever received a rose before, a lot of times there will be those little tiny green leaves at the base of the rose. Those are the sepals, right? And so they're kind of a type of modified leaf. They're used, the photosynthase from those sepals are used to produce the flower. The next structure, just typically above the sepal, are what we call the petals. If a flower is colored, typically it's the petal that has the coloration. That's not always true. There are some flowers in which the sepals are colored, some flowers in which the male and female reproductive structures are colored as well. But typically when you think of a flower, you think of a petal, which is a kind of a colored structure in most flowers. The petal is a modified leaf. Now in windborne plants like grasses, they still have petals, but they're just not colored petals. They actually, since they're not colored, we have a different name for them. They actually just surround the flower, okay, to some extent. Any questions about the petal? The next part of the flower that I want to talk about is the male reproductive part of the flower. The male reproductive part of the flower is what we call the stamen, okay? And the stamen contains three parts, or actually, I guess you'd say two main parts. The anther and the filament, okay? And the anther is where pollen is going to be produced. Now, pollen is a one-end structure, okay? It's a gamete. So the pollen's produced in the anther. And basically what the filament is it's just a structure that helps to get the anther up in the air. All right. Now if you're a flower, why would you need a filament?
To catch the pollen.
Okay, you're close.
What the anther's for, but pollen,
so. Okay, so the anther produces the pollen. And the filament holds the anther up in the air. But why does it hold it up in the air? So the wind can catch it if it's windborne pollinated? Or what else? Or if there's a bee that comes along, for example, or a bird or a bat, what's going to happen? That if the anther was sitting down here in the bottom part of the flower, would pollination occur? No, and so what happens is it has the filament, and the basic function of the filament is to get the anther up in the into the air. Okay, and so when a pollinator comes along, basically what happens is the pollination, or at least the transfer of pollen, occurs passively. When a bird or a moth comes into a flower, they're not thinking about picking up pollen, right? It just kind of attaches to structures on their body. What they're trying to get at is they're trying to get at the bottom of the flower. In most flowers that are pollinated by animals, they produce a sugary substance down here in the base of the flower called nectar. And that's what they're trying to get. Okay. And so the filament basically just gets the anther up in the air so that pollination can occur passively. Okay. Any questions about that? So the male reproductive part of the flower is called the stamen, which includes the anther and the filament. Now I should mention that some flowering plants, most flowering plants have both male and female reproductive structures in the same flower. There are some flowering plants that have distinctly male flowers and distinctly female flowers. A good example of this would be corn. The tassels at the top are the male flower, and then where the corn is produced, that's the female, or the female flower. But most flowers have both male and female reproductive structures in the same flower. Okay? Any questions about that? The next part of the plant that we want to talk a little bit about is what we call the pistil. The pistil is the female part of the flower, and it contains three parts. The stigma, the style, and the ovaries. Okay? Maybe the main part of the female part of the plant is the ovaries. The ovaries are where the gametes are going to be produced, and so this is where fertilization is going to occur, is down here. Okay. Now, what then is the function of the stigma and the style? Okay, to get the pollen somehow. Okay. The stigma is actually kind of a sticky-like structure. And so what happens is if a bee comes along, or if it's a windborne pollen grain, if pollen comes in contact with the stigma kind of, it's kind of like a, you know, a little bit sticky, like sticky tape, and the pollen will actually attach to the stigma. That kind of makes sense to everybody. What's the function of the style then? Okay, the function of the style is to get the stigma up in the air. Okay. And you need the stigma up in the air for the same reason that you need the anthers up in the air, right? In other words, if a bee or a bird comes in, or some animal pollinator, what has to happen? You need that pollination to occur passively, okay? And so in order to get that stigma up off the bottom of the flower, the style basically is a structure that helps to get the stigma up in the air so that passive pollination can occur, okay? Any questions about that?
How does the pollen move down in after it gets separated?
It actually eats down in using enzymes. Okay. Pollen grains, that's a good question. Pollen grains, like spermatozoa in humans, remember we talked about spermatozoa and that really there's only part of the cell that's one end, right? It's the spermatid, the part that's going to fuse with the female cell. In addition, the spermatozoa had an acrosome. Remember the acrosome?
Yes.
Like little cap. And then it had the midpiece and the tail, which are modifications to that spermatid. In plants, the pollen grains have similar types of modifications. Not the same, but somewhat similar. If you look at a pollen grain, there's only a part of the pollen grain that's one end. And then there's other parts of the pollen grain that hold enzymes, so that can eat through the stigma and the style, essentially, or kind of dissolve its way down through. It also has motility structures. For example, some pollen grains will have little wings, wing-like structures attached to them, like here and here. Other pollen grains will have a surface that's irregular. You can actually identify different species of plant by the shape of their pollen grain. And so each species kind of modifies their pollen grain just a little bit differently. This would be something that would be a windborne type pollen grain. So it's kind of like wings to keep it up in the air for longer periods of time. Some of the pollen that's produced in flowers that are fertilized by animals, they'll have little, maybe like little hooks on them, and so forth. So each pollen grain is modified. Any questions about that? So, the next question is, what is different about the angiosperms versus the gymnosperms? I kind of briefly mentioned this on Monday. The first major difference is that they have flowers, right? So they have their flowering plants. Then we also said there's going to be a difference in the seed structure of angiosperms versus the gymnosperms. And the difference in the seed structure is due to something in the angiosperms that we call double fertilization. Okay, in angiosperms, there's going to be two fertilization events instead of just one. And we're going to talk about why that occurs. Okay, so this is a professionally done picture, but I'm going to draw it up here because this picture, I think, is a little bit confusing. Okay, so if we have the female reproductive part of the plant, the pistil, it contains a stigma, a style, and then the ovary down here with the ovules in it. So here's a 1M ovule. Now, before we talk about this, I want to quickly review gametogenesis. Okay, and we talked about gametogenesis in humans, but gametogenesis in plants is very, very similar. Right? And the part of gametogenesis I want to review is the female gametogenesis. If you remember, we started out with the cell that was 4N, right, in the female, in female humans. In our first meiotic division, we ended up with two 2N cells. But one of those 2N cells was what? Much smaller. Why was it smaller? Okay, so that because all the nutrients went with the ovum, or what's going to potentially become the ovum. We called this, if you remember, a polar body. And what did we say happened with polar bodies in humans?
They die.
Yeah, they basically just die and are reabsorbed. Now here's where things are a little bit different in the flowering plants. The polar bodies don't die. Actually what happens is they will go through the second meiotic division, and what will be produced here is the one end ovum, okay, or ovule, and then you have three one end polar bodies. Okay, everybody kind of remember that from gametogenesis. Now that's very important in plant fertilization, because not only is there an ovum with this one end here associated with the ovule, what also happens is that there are two one end polar bodies that kind of stick around this one end ovum. Okay? Any questions so far? Now, what's going to happen is a pollen grain is going to land on the stigma, right? And that pollen grain, as we mentioned just a minute ago, has enzymes associated with it, right? And so what's going to happen is the one end genetic material of this pollen grain is actually going to eat down through the stigma and the style and eventually into the ovary. Now, here's where something really different occurs, okay, in plants versus in animals. As this sperm nuclei, we call it a sperm nuclei, it's really what it is, it's the one end cell within the pollen grain, okay? That sperm nuclei goes through mitosis, okay? Goes through mitosis. So if a one-end cell goes through mitosis, what's going to be produced? Yeah, two haploid cells. Does that make sense? Okay. So if a one-end cell goes through mitosis, what's going to happen is we're going to produce two brand new one-end nuclei. All right? So we call these the sperm nuclei. So there are two one-end sperm nuclei. Now one of these two-end sperm nuclei, I'm going to draw them here, two one-end structures. The one sperm nuclei fertilizes the ovum, and that gives us a what? A two-end zygote, right? Okay. So this is going to be the embryo. That's what's going to be our future plant. Does that make sense? So you're probably all expecting that to happen, right? Now here's what you probably were not expecting. This one-end sperm nuclei is going to fuse with two of the one-end polar bodies, okay? And it's going to produce a three-end structure that we call an endosperm. Okay? So the one sperm nuclei fuses with two one-end polar bodies to produce a three-end endosperm. Are there any questions about that? Now, what good is this 3N structure, right? You're probably wondering, why is this so important? What is this 3N structure? Well, the endosperm is actually a very important part of the seed of a plant, okay? Remember when we talked about the seed, I drew a seed up here when we were talking about the gymnosperms, and we said inside of that seed we have the embryo, right? Okay, so this is the embryo. Now that embryo is a result of what? The one sperm nuclei fertilizing the ovum. Okay, that's what we would expect. Now, we also said that there was food in here. And here's what makes the angiosperms different from the gymnosperms, or the major differences. This food here in the angiosperm seed is actually 3N material that we call endosperm. Okay, so the food around the embryo is what we call endosperm. Okay. Any questions about that? So for example, have any of you ever cracked open a piece of wheat before? Or another seed? Inside of that seed there will be a bunch of white gunk, okay? That's actually what they extract out of wheat to make bread, okay? It's the endosperm. That endosperm is the food for the seed, okay? Any questions about that? Now in addition, there's going to be a structure that surrounds the seed called a seed coat, okay, which which is here, and sometimes the seed coat is thick and sometimes it isn't. But really, there, because of this fusion of three one-inch structures, what's produced here is a lot of food for the angiosperm seed. And so angiosperm seeds can last longer in an unsuitable environment than gymnosperm seeds in relationship to the size of the seed. Okay. Angiosperm seeds, typically, if you, again, if we were to talk about the how you plant seeds, you plant them in the ground. You can plant angiosperm seeds much deeper than gymnosperm seeds, which is kind of an evolutionary advantage, because the deeper the seed can be planted, kind of the better off it is in many ways. And the reason why it's a little bit better off is because the ground is usually moister the deeper you get down in the ground, right? Okay. If you're right on top of the surface of the soil, there's not a lot of moisture. If you're just barely under it, that actually dries out fairly quickly as well. Okay. So that's why angiosperms have been the most successful types of plants in the world, and why there are more species of angiosperms than gymnosperms, and why we find angiosperms more commonly throughout the world. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So like in the, like a wheat plant, it's like you plant the endosperm,
you actually plant the whole seed, you actually plant this whole thing.
Oh, okay.
So when you open up a wheat, there's actually an embryo in there, okay, that's actually alive.
The endosperm is just the inside, that white.
Yes, all the white stuff. If you look really close when you open up the next wheat, you open up, there's like the white stuff, which is the endosperm. And then you'll see a little black piece in the middle, or dark brown. That's the embryo.
Oh.
Okay, that's the living part of the seed. Okay. Any questions? Any other questions about double fertilization? So, the reason why it's called double fertilization again is because the pollen grain divides and one of the sperm nuclei fuses with the ovum. That's fertilization event number one, right? Okay. The other sperm nuclei is going to fuse with two 1N polar bodies to produce a 3N structure that we call the endosperm, or the food for the seed. So there's the second fertilization event, right? So we have double fertilization. We have fertilization of the ovum, and then we have fertilization of the two 1N polar bodies to produce an endosperm, or the food for the seed. Okay? Any questions about that? So that's basically why the angiosperms are much more successful from an evolutionary perspective than the gymnosperms, is because they have double fertilization, right? And again, pollination in many angiosperm plants is much more sure than what you would find in the gymnosperms. Because all of the gymnosperms are windborne pollinated, and many of the angiosperms are actually pollinated by animals, which is, you actually have to produce less pollen grain. If you think about flowers, there's a couple of different strategies with flowers. If you produce flower colored petals, that takes energy, right? And so if you produce colored petals, what you're hoping to do is attract an animal pollinator. Therefore, flowering plants that produce, that have colored petals, they actually don't produce as much pollen, okay? Windborne pollinators like grass, they don't waste their energy on producing a colored petal, right? What they actually do is they put all of their energy into producing more pollen. And so there's kind of two different energy strategies when we talk about flowering plants. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. Before we go today, I want to just mention one other thing, and that is